Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
Welcome, everybody, to Lost in the Static. I am, as always, or at least for now, Scott Murray.
We'll see.
We'll see. And with me today, as always and forever, whether we want him or not, my dear co-host Josh Hadley.
You know what? If you're going to be a dick, then do Al's promo.
Okay, fine. You can go to whatever and pick up this stupid systemless bundle and you'll get a light bulb joke.
DriveThruRPG.com and you get the systemless settings bundle and tell them that Scott and Josh sent you and you get a light bulb joke.
Fine.
It'll make sense at the time.
Then you go to AdamandEve.com and you get your damn rocks off.
And then you use the promo code
you
static.
Put something in at the end and they give you crap.
And then they give you 3 free DVDs, 50% off a single item, free US shipping, and a free mystery gift. You know what pump you up for this show?
What?
Finding out that Animal House had a sitcom.
Animal House never had a sitcom. I don't know what you're talking about. At all.
You're an idiot.
And you're right. What the hell is this?
The crazy wild and the rough and rude.
It yep. did. It
yep.
really it
for
honestly...
5 episodes. They had a sitcom. Now here's the thing though. Nobody's seen it. I mean it aired, so I mean I'm sure some people saw it, but I've never seen an episode. Brad Jones can't find it. My contacts on the bootleg circuit, these 5 episodes, I don't know if it was laugh track or not laugh track. I can't find episodes of Delta House.
And the really strange thing is some of the actors from the movie came back.
4 actors from the films were in the movie. I don't know if they were just on hard times or dump truckfuls of money were involved. But I can only assume taking something like Animal House and making it into a 1970s sitcom. Neutered is the only word we could use. That's the only way they could have done it.
Yeah.
I can't see how this could have worked. And yes, it's an official. There's Bluto in there and Animal and everybody. And even right in the opening credits, based on the movie National Lampoon's Animal House.
Yeah. I mean, it's there's no bones about it. But let's be honest. The comedy of Belushi has never translated to television. There has never he's never had a successful television show. Save one.
Saturday Night Live.
Yes. and everybody who was listening to the first half of that sentence is like, but what about?
Well, okay. Then that begs the question. Why would you take something like we've talked about before how you take Conan, RoboCop, Toxic Avenger, except, you know, Rambo, and you make them into kids' cartoons. But what makes you take a hard R movie and say, this could be a family-friendly sitcom?
See, I don't know. I don't understand the thought behind that one at all. And this isn't the only case of a hard R.
No, do you remember Blazing Saddles, right?
Of course.
Did you know Blazing Saddles had at least an attempt at a TV show?
No.
And Bart.
Yeah, let's not try and play this off. You showed me this episode, the full episode of Black Bart.
No, you only got about 5 minutes in before you were like, no.
But the full episode is available on YouTube for whoever wants to check it out.
It never aired, though, so we didn't see this till the post-2000s that this finally came out.
This was an extra on the Blazing Saddles DVD, right?
Yes. It actually aired once on the Trio channel on their unaired pilot special, or their unaired pilots week, but the Trio channel doesn't even exist anymore, so how many fucking people watched it off Trio?
Exactly. But, yeah, this was produced by Mel Brooks.
Louis Gossett Jr. in the role of Bart, because Cleavon Little, I mean, it's not like he hadn't done TV. He was on The Jeffersons and All in the Family, but maybe he was just unavailable.
Yeah, who knows where he went. Maybe he was riding high on his success.
I think high was involved because he had a drug problem time. So.
But yeah, Louis Gossett Jr. as...
No, Louis Gossett.
Louis Gossett. You said Jr.
I know, but you correct myself. He's not credited with Jr. He's just Louis Gossett in this.
Actually, he's credited as Lou Gossett.
And he's not bad. First of all, he looks like he's having a good time. Mel Brooks said about this Black Bart pilot, though, that it felt like... I mean, and he'd worked in TV before, so it's not like he was unfamiliar with the process. But it felt like he was handcuffed and neutered the whole time because he knew this should have been harder than it was. Like, they couldn't say nigger. How many times did they say nigger in the movie? 100 or so?
Actually, they said nigger in the pilot.
Did they? Okay.
Yep.
They had to dance around. I mean, Lily von Stupp, they had to change her name to Belle because Stupp kind of has, you know, an implied
Lily
reference.
Von Belle.
Yeah, so... You know, you can tell that this didn't work, but this wasn't the only time, as you pointed out. Like, until I played you this open that we're about to play, Scott did not know this existed.
I had no idea, and I'm actually a little proud of that fact.
That honestly, you didn't know?
That I didn't.
Listen to your mother.
That's Fast Times at Ridgemont High, or the TV show was just called Fast Times. Dean Cameron as Spicoli. You got Michael Scarravelli and Ray Waltzon coming back as their movie characters, and this unknown actor named Patrick Dempsey as Rat.
Yeah. Courtney Thorne-Smith,
too, yeah.
I mean, these were future successes as far as the cast went, and...
I think this lasted 6 or 7 episodes, and it went bye-bye, because it's bad, man. It is really, really bad.
And what makes it bad? Is it bad compared to the movie Fast Times at Ridgemont High? Do they shoot and miss the mark? What happens here?
Kind of both. It obviously, when you compare it to the movie, it's going to come across weak, sanitized, and neutered, because it's
like
network
anything
TV.
On TV, yeah.
But at the same time, the laugh track, it's got just every sitcom trope of, you know, misunderstandings, you know, I've got 2 dates on the same day, and, Spicoli's going to try and, you know, go between the two. You know, it's an average sitcom that happens to have Spicoli and Rat and Mr. Hand in it.
Was this a Saved by the Bell aimed at adults instead of teens?
I wouldn't even say aimed at adults because it's sanitized.
Was it Saved by the Bell aimed at teens and later teens versus preteens and
Spicoli's trying to be so cool, dude, with, you know, no weed references or anything like that, obviously allowed. But, you know, they were clearly trying to get Spicoli to be the breakout character because he kind of was in the movie.
Yeah.
And Dean Cameron. On Dean Cameron's old website, which isn't up now, but maybe is up on archive.org or the Wayback Machine, he went through every single movie and TV role he had and explained what a mistake or what a boon it was. This was on the mistake list that he thought, I'm going to be playing Spicoli. This is going to be great for my career. What do you mean I'm unhireable?
Yeah, because you can't do anything else after you've done Spicoli. You will always be Spicoli.
Well, I mean, you know, after that he got Summer School. Yes. and They Came from Outer Space, or They Came from Beyond Outer Space, or whatever.
They Came from Beyond Midnight. No. In Outer Space.
No. And now, and
Radiodrome.
Now, there is one other that tried this same formula. Now, Ferris Bueller.
Oh.
Okay. I enjoy the movie on a certain level, and I hate the movie on a certain level. The TV series was fucking terrible. And no, for those of you that are about to go, the TV series was Parker Lewis Can't Lose. I know Parker Lewis Can't Lose was a total ripoff of Ferris Bueller, but there was actually a Ferris Bueller TV series too, which is fucking terrible.
And I remember enjoying Parker Lewis Can't Lose.
Me too.
I don't know if I actually would enjoy it if I went back and watched some episodes, but I remember enjoying it.
But see, here's the thing about Ferris Bueller, the TV show. There are two kind of breakout stars. Amy Dolenz, you know, she's a stand-up comic and she does lots of comic stuff. Yeah. And this little go-nowhere actress named Jennifer Aniston.
Yeah, it's a shame. Really, you can see the talent in her face. It's a
not
shame
in this
she
show,
didn't go
you can't.
To, well, I know.
No, because yeah. This... And this is... You guys can't see this, but if you could see the graphics coupled with the music you're about to hear, this is about as late 80s as you can get without actually traveling back in time.
Yeah, what year did this come out?
I think it was 88, but I might be wrong on that.
Okay, so this came out just a couple of years before Parker Lewis Can't Lose.
Yeah.
Because Parker Lewis Can't Lose was about as 90s as you could get.
Oh, fuck yeah.
And this is about as 80s as you could get. I mean, he's Cosby dancing.
Where's Toe Jam and Earl? This is the Toe Jam and Earl soundtrack, isn't it?
No, this is too 80s to be Toe Jam and Earl.
All right, just turn this off. Just enough. And that is as fucking late 80s as you can get, people.
Yeah, and he really was. I kid you not. He was Cosby dancing.
Uh-huh. Against a green screen.
Against the green screen through the credits and interacting with the words.
Actually, back then it was probably a blue screen, honestly.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. No, 88, that would have been the beginning.
That would have started, okay.
I'm kind of guessing somebody with a budget, and I realize that's not a huge budget show. But somebody with
it's a sitcom on network TV.
But with a network sitcom budget, would be doing green screen at the time. Anyway, here's where I see a problem with Ferris Bueller and quite a few TV adaptations. The Ferris Bueller in this TV show, and honestly, folks, all I have seen is the credit sequence.
I've seen actual episodes.
Yeah, Josh has seen actual episodes because they aired on television, and Josh has seen all of it.
I have copies of them.
Yeah, he's off character.
What he seems like is, and I know how redundant this is going to sound, he seems like a TV version of a movie character.
Okay.
And I know that sounds redundant, but that makes sense, doesn't it?
He seems like your buddy trying to act like Ferris Bueller. Because as far as Ferris Bueller goes,
Matthew Broderick was Matthew Broderick, yeah. Yes. Or Matthew Broderick was Ferris
was
Bueller.
Was Ferris Bueller. And it was, I mean, that same Ferris Bueller came out in a lot of movies that he did after that. It took him a while.
Oh,
I mean,
hell yeah.
Well, look at Lady Hawk. You can even see Ferris Bueller in Lady Hawk.
Oh, unfortunately.
You know, but that was the character. And this, obviously being a television adaptation, excuse me, was somebody else trying to be. And that's what I've noticed with a lot of these. Both, I mean, I've seen successful TV shows.
Oh, yeah.
TV adaptations.
We're not just going to be talking about bad ones.
Right. That were trying to be at first and then veered away, and that's kind of when they got good.
Well, now, you didn't like the show, but look at the Terminator, the Sarah Connor Chronicles. Leah Headey really did make Sarah Connor her own character, that she wasn't going, I'm emulating what Linda Hamilton did in the two movies. It's, I'm making this character my own, and I'm, you know, all these years after Terminator 2, the character has changed. And that works.
And let's be fair and honest, just to share with everybody, I didn't like the Sarah Connor Chronicles.
I loved it.
Because of Summer Glau.
Because she was River Tam as a robot?
She was River Tam as a robot. And it's not necessarily that she was River Tam as a robot. It's because in both River Tam and this robot Terminator, she displays the entire width and breadth of her acting talent. She emotes as much as she humanly can, playing a fucking mental patient and
a robot.
I don't, and I'm sure she's a lovely person, and I'm sure she's cool in person, but I don't like Summer Glau. I didn't like her in Firefly. I didn't like the character of River. And of River. And, well, for that matter, I didn't like the character of River Song in Doctor Who. That's a completely another tangent altogether.
Well, see, the thing with Terminator that set it apart besides some of the acting was how they chose to do it. For one, I showed you a couple of scenes. They decided to go more artistic with it, that we can't afford to do what the movies did, so let's play around with this. I mean, hell, the season one finale with Johnny Cash as the man comes around was fucking gorgeous. They knew they couldn't afford to shoot the big climactic battle with the FBI SWAT unit trying to take out Cromartie the Terminator. So they went the other way. No sound effects, just when the man comes around playing, and all you see is this up angle from the swimming pool of the hotel, and just bodies of SWAT guys flying into it and slowly bleeding out. And then you see Cromartie all shot up, and you go, that's a very artistic way to get around. We don't have the budget to shoot this. And the song sets such a tone. The best thing the Terminator series did, though, and I can remember Terminator Salvation hadn't come out yet, so it completely went out of its way to knock Terminator 3 out of continuity. They specifically said Terminator 3 did not happen.
Okay.
Because remember, in Terminator 3, Sarah Connor had, that took place in 2003, and Sarah Connor had died of cancer. Yes. So this one starts in, the pilot starts in 1999, and Summer Glau's Terminator of Cameron jumps them to 2007, when, you know, the show was made. When Sarah asks why, she goes, because in 2003 you died of cancer. Right there. They specifically went, Terminator 3 did not happen. We jumped over that and knocked that out of continuity, which by definition knocks Salvation out, since that's a direct sequel to 3 as well.
Yay.
I thought that was a ballsy move and the right move.
Yes. Yeah, and again, we're not... The thing that Terminator, the TV show, did right was you didn't have somebody in there trying to be Arnold. You didn't.
They actually had a joke set up for the third season, though, because it took place in Los Angeles, where Cameron would think that the governor of California might be a Terminator. This is when Arnold was governor.
Yeah.
I thought, okay, that might be kind of fucking funny.
That's kind of cute. But yeah, you don't have somebody trying to be Arnold Schwarzenegger. And on top of that, like you said, the lead actress didn't try to be Linda Hamilton. She made the character her own.
And the other great thing the show did was, just because you're in the credits don't mean you're safe. They had, honestly, John and Sarah were probably safe. They had a couple of surprising, you know how normally in a show you're going to get rid of a main character, there's a build up and foreshadowing? No, just on a rant, I mean, it's a spoiler here, but the show's over 5 years old, so fuck off. They're on a random mission, just an average mission. There's no build up. A Terminator shoots Derek in the head. He's been a main character since the beginning of the first season. He just gets shot in the head and killed. And you go, okay? All right, you're actually going to kill main characters randomly. I like that.
And you thought Game of Thrones did it first.
It's like, you know, no foreshadowing. But then you've got other ones that sometimes, because it's weird, because like with Terminator and Delta House and all that, and even Black Bart, the movies happened. Yes. And these are following the movies.
Yes.
What about the ones where they kind of go, no, we're going to kind of remake the movie at the same time as going in our own direction with it? I loved this show, okay?
Like this one?
Yes. I loved this show, and I'll explain it more after you guys hear it.
Okay. There it is.
That was the scene in California's Mojave Desert 5 years ago. Our historic first view of the newcomer's ship. Theirs was a slave ship carrying 250,000 beings bred to adapt and labor in any environment. But they've washed ashore on Earth with no way to get back to where they came from. And in the last 5 years, the newcomers have become the latest addition to the population of Los Angeles.
You that might not have recognized that, that was Alien Nation the series.
Yes.
Now, here was the thing that Alien Nation the series did, because Kenneth Johnson was on record when the movie came out in 89. He was not happy with it. Or 88, whatever year. I think it was 88. He was not happy with the movie. He said Gail Ann Hurd, notorious kind of, you know, uber producer, went and changed his, what he thought was a unique script and a unique social commentary on America and how it failed to become the melting pot that it was, and she just turned it into a generic buddy cop film where one of the buddies happens to be an alien. He was not happy with the movie at all. So when he got the go-ahead from Fox to make it into a TV series, he said, I'm going to correct that. The movie essentially never happened. The pilot, the two-hour pilot of Alien Nation, it's not the story of the movie, but it's clearly saying the movie didn't happen. For instance, in the movie, George has four kids. In the TV series, he doesn't have his fourth kid until way late in the show. His name is George Francisco, straight out in the TV series. Do you remember why he's George Francisco from the movie?
No.
In an allusion to Ellis Island, they're giving all the newcomers names, and they started running out of names after a while. So his given name was Sam Francisco. And they're like, no, I'm not calling him Sam Francisco. You're George. You're smiling. That's actually a good, you know. It's no, I'm bit. Not calling him Sam Francisco. And what the TV series did, it's way expanded the mythology of the show. Way, way greater than the movie ever could have.
I was always surprised when it comes, because Alien Nation kind of happened, and I was aware that it happened, and I watched.
This is also the era when Fox was taking chances.
Yeah, and I watched the TV show and I enjoyed it, but the movie was a blip and it was gone
because it wasn't that good.
Right, but the TV show it always amazed me every time I watched it. Whoever came up with the newcomers and
which would be Kenneth Johnson.
Well, Kenneth Johnson and their whole history. I mean, they had a language, they had
ritual,
they had everything fleshed out to such a degree. It was it really was like a glimpse into this new culture.
Well, you know some of the other things Kenneth Johnson did, right? I mean, he's one of those guys where you go, okay, he's a quality guy. He only did things like the first two V miniseries and Farscape, and you know, this is a Twilight Zone, and this is one of those guys where you go, yeah, he's always been about quality,
right?
And what they did with Alien Nation was took chances.
Did it work?
On a creative level, yes. On a ratings level, no. That's why it ends after one season. There are five TV movies later, but that's only due to fan outcry and a letter writing campaign. But no, it only lasted one season because the ratings were terrible. And obviously a show like this, you need a budget. The show is very, very expensive.
Yes.
Because it takes place in a near future. Got to remember, guys, this is 1990. So it takes place in the near future of the late 90s when all this happens. And they dealt with racism. They dealt with interracial dating, or interspecies dating in this case. And probably the ballsiest thing they did, both in a pun and not a pun.
Three-way.
Yeah. Three ways are normal. The only way newcomers can have children are with two males and the female getting together to fertilize the egg, and then the males give birth. That's ballsy for 1990, man. For broadcast TV, yes, you're cloaking it in an alien sheen, but that's still pretty ballsy, don't you think?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, land-based seahorses.
You know, and then there's one thing that people might, she never appears in the credits or anything, or the opening credits. There was this unknown actress that showed up on this show a few times as a TV reporter. Angela Bassett pops in a couple of times as a TV reporter.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, she was this unknown actress at the time. It's just kind of funny when you look at it like that.
It's, you know, I have to admit that is one of the things I've enjoyed about this show is going back and looking at this stuff, and you're like, she was in that?
Well, they're famous. Well, okay. Probably the biggest one of those would be Working Girl. You and I were talking about Working Girl before, and that's one of the biggest. Holy crap. That lady's a fucking superstar now. Yeah. This show was canceled after like 10 episodes.
Which, yeah, I don't remember this show at all, and I want to talk about why after you listen to this. And that's enough.
You don't
of that
need any more of that.
It's just a song. But you'll notice that number one on the credits was Sandra Bullock.
Mm-hmm. As the Working Girl. And then her villain boss is Nana Visitor, who you didn't recognize the name, but when I went, that's Major Kira from Deep Space Nine, you were like, what?
Oh, okay.
You had this giant revelation fall over your face, like, wow.
And which it sounds like a guest you're having over at your grandmother's
Nana
house.
Visitor?
Or Nana Visitor, yes.
It's pronounced Nana. I've heard her pronounce it Nana. You got to say it fast, Nana.
Shanana?
I don't know.
Nana.
But, yeah, Working Girl lasted, I think, like 10 episodes. And I think some of them didn't even air until TV Land. Because I think TV Land, one of their big things was they had the couple of unaired Working Girl episodes when TV Land aired them in the mid-90s. This is when Sandra Bullock was becoming a big name, though. So, this was, we've got the Sandra Bullock shit you've never seen. But now, why? I can tell you why the show didn't work on a creative level, but why do you think Working Girl didn't work?
One of the reasons why the movie Working Girl worked was because the premise.
It was a pretty hard R, if I remember right, too.
It was a hard R, and the very title was a pun, because it came out in the 80s.
I know, I was going to say, isn't Working Girl a slang for a prostitute?
Well, it's slang for a prostitute, but it also came out in the 80s when more and more moms were going and
entering the workforce.
Not just entering the workforce, because there were plenty of working women in the workforce in the 70s and 60s even. It's just that they happened to be secretaries or more traditionally female workplace roles.
Okay.
Office girls, secretaries, random early 20s twats to have for, you know, the advertising head to have an affair with.
Get them sweet cheeks over here and take a memo, honey.
Exactly. And in the 80s was the first decade when kind of Wall Street and the movers and shakers of the world of finance sat up and went, wait a minute, we have female CEOs. You mean women can run companies?
And you so, shut your mouth.
And so the very premise of this working girl or of a woman trying to fight her way up the corporate ladder, it was, I wouldn't say it was shocking, but it was not common the way it is now.
Oh, and the TV show really dropped a lot of that. It was just a workplace sitcom.
It was a
really
workplace.
It was.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the TV show dropped a lot of that. The TV show came out at such a point that it wasn't shocking anymore. It wasn't a premise for a movie. I mean, it was. Imagine now that we've seen Dustin Hoffman in Tootsie, and we've seen Robin Williams in Mrs. Doubtfire.
That wouldn't be for a few more years, but
okay. I know that wouldn't be for. But I'm saying, imagine we've seen those two movies now, and we've heard of a few cases of men taking the roles of women. I mean, here's another example. Hairspray.
John Waters?
No.
Divine?
No. Well, Divine, yes, but no, you're wrong. Hairspray.
Okay,
more recent version of Hairspray.
Oh, John Travolta. Okay, so see Hairspray, I go to John Waters.
I know.
That. I'm sorry.
I do too.
You gave me the finger over that, though. What the hell?
I know, because my brain was going, no, not that one, idiot.
But I wasn't wrong.
I know. But anyway, this idea of either for comedic reasons or even in some dramatic roles of men playing traditionally female roles. A Tootsie TV show wouldn't hold the same weight now that Tootsie the movie did when Dustin Hoffman did it.
83, maybe?
Yeah. Because, you know, back then it was like cross-dressing.
And then Divine's in the corner going, honey.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have 10% of the U.S. population in the corner going, honey.
I don't know. When I think cross-dressing, I go to Divine and either walk like a man or you ain't a man.
Of course, you mentioned Divine in the only movie that comes to my brain.
Pink Flamingos? Yeah, eating the dog poop? Yeah, but whatever. Okay.
Anyway, and that was the problem with Working Girl. The shock or the idea behind the movie, the social commentary behind the movie
was gone.
And so you just ended up with this wacky workplace comedy
with a future superstar headlining it.
Yeah, and it was a role that didn't work.
It was a series that didn't work. Now, I want to talk about this next one. I'm going to be technically cheating, okay? Play the open to Freaky Links for a minute, and then I'll talk about why this one is technically still within what we're talking about here tonight, okay, Scott? Because you were even like, I don't remember the movie.
Yeah,
like, yeah, you kind of do.
No, I... Okay.
Here we go.
Might get you.
Wow, that you don't get much more mid-90s.
1999.
Really? I mean,
99.
Which is amazing because that is such a 90s intro.
It's a great show. First of all, Freaky Links was a fantastic show. But the reason I'm calling this one a technical is
the net.
This was built as Blair Witch the show. It's by the producers of the Blair Witch Project. And they sold it as Blair Witch the show. And then after they got into some development issues, it was decided, nah, let's go in a different direction and not use the... They were prepping Blair Witch 2, Book of Shadows at this point, that we don't want the TV show right now. But they still liked the premise, so they changed it into becoming Freaky Links. Now, when you watch the show, it's not all handheld, thank God. But there is a handheld element because they work for the Freaky Links website. And the show is fucking good. Now, you got to see them in order. Thank you, Fox, for not airing them in order. It's a continuity-based show, so Fox didn't air them in order. Freaky Links has one of those rare distinctions of being only 13 episodes long and being canceled 3 times in 13 episodes.
Really?
Fox aired 5 episodes, again, out of order, and the ratings were so low they canceled it. So then a letter-writing campaign and an internet campaign, they aired 4 more the next summer, and the ratings were still shit. So they're like, no, with these last 4 we're just sitting on. Another internet campaign, they just burned them off the next summer. So it took them 2.5 years to air 13 episodes, and they canceled the show 3 times. And it's a great show. I mean, they aired them so out of order that they were constantly referencing events that would happen in next week's episode.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it was like, God damn it, Fox. Well, what the fuck?
Let's be honest. It's Fox. They don't have a record of doing that ever in a million fucking Firefly years, ever. Fuck you, Fox.
And
Browncoats unite.
The thing about Freaky Links that I think is the most unique about it is the stories are just kind of eh. It's the interactions between the characters that keep you coming back. They talk to each other like real people, and their interactions are fucking hilarious. So you watch the show not for what, you know, wacky adventure they're going to go on this week, but for the interactions that wacky adventure is going to bring them to. That's why I liked Freaky Links.
That's one of the reasons.
Characters.
That's why I liked Lone Gunman. Even more than X-Files, because X-Files,
the characters were great.
Yeah, X-Files, it really was. I mean, we had Mulder,
they were
Scully.
They were secondary
and
characters. And
they were set in stone. You knew how Mulder would react. You knew how
Scully
would react. But the simple fact is the adventure was the overall story arc was why you watched X-Files.
The gunman was for all the minutiae in
exactly.
the episode.
Exactly. It was how these three crazy fuckers decided to interact with one another, and yeah, they
and usually Frohickey got the best lines.
Right,
he was also a producer, so maybe he has a hand in that.
And that's how Freaky Links was too.
Yeah, and but then you've got ones you did not know this sitcom existed.
I didn't
like the movie, but the TV show is way worse than you can imagine it is.
Okay,
you said you've never seen one. They're worse.
I've never seen the TV show. I liked the movie. I liked the movie because I like John Candy. And I like the way that he acts. And looking at this TV show, I can tell you it's another case of an actor trying to be John Candy.
Kevin Meaney is trying so hard.
And failing miserably. And
he's trying so hard to be Uncle Buck. All right, pot it down. I can't do this.
And
yeah,
okay. Now let's look at Uncle Buck the movie. It wasn't. Yes, you had Uncle Buck, which was crazy and wacky and wild, and he had some weird black sheep ways about him, but he was still relatable as a human being, and he didn't go out of his way to be crazy and wild. It was just the way he was. Kevin Meaney as Uncle Buck here.
He's a caricature of Uncle Buck.
In every single scene, in almost every interaction, he's dancing.
And he's up. And
he's upbeat and he's having a good time. And you can tell in one of the scenes in this opening.
I seem to remember from the movie, wasn't John Candy kind of borderline depressed in the movie and always kind of looking at the dark side of shit?
Am I
misremembering that?
No, he wasn't borderline depressed. He was straight up depressed. He hid it under, you know, he hid it for the kids. He was crazy and upbeat and wacky, and he made the giant pancake for the kids and for their benefit. But at the same time, with the older daughter and with his family, he tried to put on a good facade, but he didn't hide the fact that he was down. and that there was a human underneath. This Kevin Meaney, he just seems to be a crazy, wild, and wacky guy.
Wild and crazy guy, but yeah. I'm not Steve Martin.
Exactly, and it obviously didn't work. That, and I've seen some of Kevin Meaney's early stand-up, and I like it. I don't see how that comedy would translate to TV well. No. It's too clownish.
I agree with you.
It belongs on stage. It works well on stage. It would work well in Ringling Brothers.
Well, now, let's dip back to the 70s. First of all, you didn't even know that there was a Planet of the Apes TV series.
Nope.
But when I showed you this intro, you just went, oh my God, 70s!
It is the most 70s sci-fi thing you can possibly imagine. As soon as it played, there it goes. Sorry about that audio level and the source material. It's kind of all over the place.
But, okay, the TV series was honestly all right, but I guess technically we're cheating by going from movie to... Because this is one of those ones where it said, we're not going to remake the movie, but we're also going to ignore the movies. Because, like, remember how in the movies, humans at this point couldn't speak, they had no language, and then we were borderline savages.
Right.
Here we have a complete society, we all speak fluent English, and humans are just a subculture slave class of the apes. And you go, none of the movies did that. What the fuck?
Right. And that was the shocking thing about the movies. And when I say the shocking thing, I don't mean necessarily to the audience, but to the apes and to society, the shocking thing. Yes, he talks.
Everyone makes fun of the get your hands off me, you damn dirty ape part. That part in the movie is powerful, not because of what Teston says, but because he said it. You know? That's why in the context of the movie, that's a power right there.
It would be as if you're petting your dog one day.
And he goes, dude, can you do the back a little bit?
Yeah.
And you go, dude, what the fuck?
Exactly. You know, and it's, yeah, it would be something like that. Not necessarily what he said, you know, hey, could you get the back? But The fact that he said it.
Now, there's another 70s TV show that doesn't have an intro because they would just play the credits over the opening scenes of whatever the episode was, but Shaft the series. A lot of people don't remember that Shaft had a TV show for 9 episodes. And by episodes, I mean movies. They were in 90-minute time slots, so they're all an hour 10 without commercials. That's essentially 9 TV movies when you get down to it.
Yeah, I guess so.
These didn't soft pedal. Yes, they weren't saying nigger and fuck and shit and showing boobs, but they didn't soft pedal the Shaft character. And so it was Richard Roundtree coming back as John Shaft.
Okay.
For instance, one episode was about a bunch of black guys, stereotypical black guys, who, you know, like, yo, homie, what's up, kind of black guys, who rob a bank. It's actually white guys in blackface acting like stereotypical black guys, so then the cops are looking for black guys when they just wipe the blackface off and are walking down the street away with all the money. Shaft is the only one who puts together that these guys are, this is so stereotypical, this is the way white people see black people. You go, that's kind of ballsy for a fucking 70s TV movie, isn't it?
Well, I mean,
that's a good plot.
It would be ballsy for anybody to go, okay, so let's suppose a minstrel show robbed a bank.
It kind of.
Which is what exactly what happened.
Yeah, and you go, Shaft the series, which they recently released on DVD very quietly. It's one of those ones that you can't find at a store. It's worth checking out. Yes, there's no nudity. Yes, there's no swearing. That's all that they really neutered out of the movies.
Where is Dolomite the series?
Well, we got enough movies out of that, and since with Rudy Ray Moore's death, we're never going to get it. God, please don't have Chris Tucker remake Dolomite. Please, no. Please, no. Okay. But I see your eyes going. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it. All right. Well, okay. What are some of the other ones we got here? We've got ones like, you didn't know about this show, and you went, with this cast, how did Magnificent Seven slip under the radar in the 90s?
I mean, it was an excellent Western movie. I loved it. I'll watch it on a quiet weekend just because it's the fucking Magnificent. I have the soundtrack, and whenever I need to get pumped up, it sounds dumb, but whenever I need to get pumped up or I'm traveling cross country,
play the open, because I thought the open uses part of the theme, man. But yeah, this was the 1990s TV show.
I got to tell you, I grew up on with a family farm. We still have the family farm. I still have horses there. My sister keeps a CD of the Magnificent Seven in the barn. So just so that when I go to Muncie, we can both ride out of the barn with the Magnificent Seven blaring behind us.
Are you going to go find this show now? Because it's on DVD.
No, I'm not, because I don't really.
Okay. The show was on CBS. It didn't do very well, but you've got Rick Worthy, you know, tons of sci-fi stuff. You got Ron Perlman, Michael Biehn, Anthony Stark. You got Dale Mitkoff. You got Robert Vaughn from The Magnificent Seven. Obviously, he's not playing the same character,
right,
in this as a judge in a regular basis. And you go, what the fuck? You know why it failed?
Western in the 90s.
Well, that and formulaic plots.
Yeah.
You know? It was just regular Western formulaic plot. In all honesty, the only modern Western, and I mean that's actually like a Western, not like, you know, Elmore Leonard called Justified a modern Western, and he's kind of right. But the only modern Western really that worked was Deadwood. I thought Deadwood was fucking fantastic. That's a different topic.
But yeah, I don't know what it is about modern. Because let's face it, Firefly is a modern Western.
Yes.
A modern Western. You've got not just Deadwood. There was the train one.
The one on, it was on FX.
Hell
on Wheels.
Hell on Wheels, that's it.
And that didn't work very well because the ratings were terrible.
Yeah, that didn't work very well. You had Magnificent Seven, didn't work very well. Really, I think Deadwood.
Briscoe County Jr.
Briscoe County.
That tanked, man. That didn't work well with audiences at all.
That was a great show that failed because
it was Fox in 1994.
Yeah. But it was I enjoy the show.
I have all the Columbia House tapes.
I had the whole series on DVD, and I think I sold it during one of our dark times. But anyway. But yeah, great cast, decently shot. They obviously had a budget.
That was part of the problem. The ratings did not justify the budget. Because the ratings weren't fucking, like, terrible bottom of the barrel, but it was, for the $2 million an episode, your ratings are not good enough for this. No.
That's because the writing didn't justify the budget either.
Exactly.
The budget went into the visuals and the titles and all of
and
that
cast.
Stuff. And the cast.
So I'm sure Ron Perlman and Michael Biehn were probably not cheap.
Yeah, and it did not go into the writing at all. The stories, like I said, they flatlined.
Well, now, I do want to talk about one you and I talked about before the show, Freddy's Nightmares. You said you remember liking the show, but you kind of have to go back to it.
I hesitate to watch any of Freddy's Nightmares because, I remember being up late, I remember being young, and I remember enjoying the show. Will I now, if I go back and see them? Probably not.
Play the intro for him.
Oh, all righty then. I will do just that.
And that was the season one intro because that had the full title.
Right.
The full title for season one was Freddy's Nightmares on Nightmare on Elm Street, the series. Kind of a mouthful. Season two, it was just Freddy's Nightmares. They dropped the Nightmare on Elm Street, the series thing. This show never did well, and yet got two full seasons. It was picked up for two guaranteed seasons before the syndicators ever saw an episode.
The problem was that this show never had a proper home.
Well, it was first-run syndication, that's why.
It was first-run syndication. It was in that weird of, we're going to try and be on network TV, and we're going to follow their rules, but we've got Freddy Krueger and the whole Nightmare on Elm Street angle and that side.
To a degree, this was specifically sold as a late-night adult series.
And they kept putting it on earlier in,
like 7
and earlier
PM
and earlier.
And stuff.
Prime time it ended up in.
And like, this was meant to be an after the news. That's when Freddy's Nightmares comes on.
The kids have gone to bed. Mom and dad want to watch something.
Seriously.
Yeah.
One thing, if you do watch some of these again, you'll notice they are like pixels away from showing nipples and buttholes in some of these for some of the naked women. They were right on the line of what you could do for the FCC. There are so many instances of side boob where I'm like, if that hand or that flower pot is moved a centimeter, there's nipple on screen. There's a lot of that. They really, honestly, some of the gore in this is gorier than R-rated movies at the time. They were really pushing the boundaries with this, which is, honestly, that's, I think, where all the effort went, because it certainly wasn't in the scripts.
Yeah.
You know, it certainly wasn't in the scripts. That was the problem.
You know, but this is something that was supposed to air late night, and as we record this, it is 7:02.
It would be on right now.
It would be on right now.
And the thing that really killed it was the fact that Freddy's Nightmares, A Nightmare on Elm Street, the series, you expect Freddy Krueger. Out of the 44 episodes, he stars in maybe 16. Otherwise, he's just his crypt keeper type host.
I was going to say, but he
is involved in the stories of maybe a quarter, if that, of the episodes. And I think that's what threw people off, was they were expecting him. Why is Freddy just bitching about this person and their adventure? What the fuck?
Now, let's be honest. You can't mention Freddy's Nightmares without its syndicated partner, War of the Worlds.
I loved War of the Worlds.
I enjoyed the first season, and then the second season just went off the deep end.
And see, I didn't like the first season as much, and I thought the second season was fucking phenomenal. You know, the second season...
Excuse me, I'm apparently allergic to first-run syndication.
The second season was just amazing. I loved it. And it just was... It was a blip on the radar. It didn't go very far. I mean, two seasons with a rushed ending, because they found out after... As they were shooting the season finale, that it would be a series finale, so a quick rewrite, and hey, now it's a series finale. Doesn't wrap up any of the plot lines we set up, but deal with it.
Yeah, we've talked about it in the past. Yeah. Now, let's briefly mention another two. First off, FX, the TV show.
Which,
not the network, not...
No, right. But, it's off the two Brian Dennehy movies,
right.
Which... First one I remember being really good. The second one I remember hating.
Yeah, and let's be honest, what it was a somewhat atypical fighting crime with smooth jazz, typical 90s cop show.
To a degree,
with
a special effects guy working for the CIA.
Yeah, it was a nod, mm-hmm. and there were tons and tons of nods to the effects industry.
There were lots of problems too.
It just did not translate well.
Well, one of the problems was the teaser fake out on every single episode, Scott. It started with, you know, like an alien chasing somebody or something, then cut, and you see it's a movie set. That works once, maybe twice, not 44 times.
Right.
Every single episode started with one of those, and I'm like, oh my God. Seriously?
And one that was kind of middle of the road. We're done. Good night, everybody.
Okay.
Sorry.
But play the outro. We're done. We're out
exactly.
of time.
Bye.
No, play the outro. Play it.
Okay.
Lost in the Static is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows. 2.